Good evening, everybody. I'm Dick Miley, as president of the Cook Inlet Historical Society. The board of Cook Inlet Historical Society welcomes you to the first lecture of our 2021-2022 season. Before introducing our topic and moderator, a couple of announcements. First, as many of you know, in pre-pandemic days, these lectures were held in person at the Anchorage Museum Auditorium. But starting in spring of 2020, rather than cancel events with the technical support from the Anchorage Museum, specifically Rebecca Pottenbaum, we transitioned to online events. In recognition of these efforts to continue our talks despite the pandemic, the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the Anchorage Museum are the proud recipients of the 2021 Elva R. Scott Local Historical Society Award presented by the Alaska Historical Society. This is the award. I know it's kind of glary, but... Town decades, McCarthy and Kennecott, the time between the closure of the Kennecott mines in 1938 up to the creation of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park in the early 1980s. Again, that's November 18th at 7 p.m. Tonight's talk is the first talk in our 2021-2022 series. This fall's presentations are all virtual. They are free and open to the public via Crowdcast. The same link you used for signing on today can be used to review the recorded event after the program conclusion. If you enjoy these programs, please join or donate to the Cook Inlet Historical Society. Your membership and donations enable us to hold these events and promote the study of history in the Cook Inlet area. The website to donate will be posted in the chat bar. Two housekeeping notes. There will be an opportunity for panelists to ask for, not panelists, for participants to answer questions. To ask questions, excuse me. So please post your questions using the chat link on your screen. Now to tonight's discussion. 50 years ago, on December 18, 1971, President Richard Nixon signed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, usually referred to as ANCSA. ANCSA marked a shift in the congressional approach to federal policy for indigenous communities and lands. The landmark passage of ANCSA created for-profit corporations tasked with promoting the social, cultural, and economic advancement of their Alaska Native people and communities. Tonight, a panel of three award-winning journalists who have reported extensively on Alaska Native issues and ANCSA will discuss ANCSA's past, present, and future legacy. Tonight's discussion is moderated by Dr. Will Schneider, joining us from Fairbanks. Will is Professor Emeritus at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where he was curator of the Oral History Project at Elmer Rasmussen Library and taught anthropology. He is the recent past president of the Alaska Historical Society. Will introduce the panelists, and I will turn it over to Will now. Thank you, Will, for setting up and moderating tonight's discussion. And Will, you're muted.
Thank you, Dick. Am I on now?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for this opportunity. And also thanks to Ian for the invitation. The original idea for this panel really comes from Ron Inouye, who is the origin of a lot of great ideas, but he said we really ought to look at the journalists who covered ANCSA over the years, and so that was the impetus for this. I also want to pay recognition to Irene Rowan, whose ANCSA at 50 meetings have opened all of our eyes to the wealth of reporting on ANCSA over the years. Print, film, radio shows, interviews, websites, TV programming, they're all reported on in the ANCSA at 50 series. I also want to mention the Alaska Historical Society's project, A Guide to Sources for the Study of ANCSA. This work has brought to our attention the tremendous amount of audio, visual, and print that's available on the subject. This speaks to the importance of the topic that we're approaching tonight, journalists covering ANCSA. Our panelists, we are really pleased to have Rhonda McBride with us tonight. Rhonda's work in the Bethel region with KYUK started in 1988, where she was introduced to many of the issues facing natives in that region during that particular time period. Today, she lives and works in Juneau at K2, where she is the arts and culture producer. You may all recognize her work as producer of Frontiers, a television show that featured coverage of Alaskan issues. Jacqueline Estes is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. Previously, she served as news director for KBNA 90.3 FM, an Alaska Native news station. Her reporting has covered many aspects of Alaska Native life, from issues of health and safety to Native vendors at the Alaska State Fair. Look for her upcoming article on Alaska Native land claims in Indian Country Today. As a side note, Jacqueline was a co-author with Barbara Sweetland Smith on a survey of Alaska Native organizations and corporations that was produced back in 1979. Jacqueline is a Tlingit and Sea Alaska shareholder. John Butsky is an Inupiat who grew up in Anchorage and Nome with ancestors from Wales and King Island. He's the owner of the company Talking Circle Media and has over 30 years of experience filming documentaries in Alaska. Over the years, John has filmed the Alaska Federation of Native meetings, producing an invaluable record of events and perspectives on Native issues. But before turning the program over to our speakers, I want to give a brief look at ANCSA itself, and I'll limit it to about 5 minutes. So it's a quick overview. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971 culminated years of struggle to have Native land claims formally recognized by the state and the federal government and legally settled. Statehood in 1959 was based on a constitution that had conflicting mandates. State was able to select land, but the state also had to avoid land that might be subject to Native rights. So there was really a conflict there. The new state moved to select land, and conflicts with the Native interests followed. Native organizations were formed to find avenues to respond to this crisis. And out of that came AFN and the push for land claims. The land freeze by the Secretary of the Interior and the discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay added fuel to the need for a land claim settlement. Land claims legislation and passage of a bill, 44 million acres, close to $1 billion in settlement, established corporations as a means and avenue for the disbursement of the funding. There are lots of issues that developed. The wealth of the corporations is indisputable, and the benefits to the economy are there. But there are divisions over who can hold shares, the corporate versus tribal identity, the extent of federal trust responsibility in the age of land claims, and the sovereignty of tribes today. All of these are issues that are being faced. I've come to think of those early ANCSA leaders as really rivaling in importance to the delegates to the Alaska Constitutional Convention, because what they were doing was creating a new reality for Alaskans. And so I think that their role in history is incredibly important for us to recognize and appreciate. And now to our panelists who have covered the developments that give life to this important part of Alaska history. Our first speaker is Rhonda McBride.
Thank you, Will. You know, I think a lot of Alaskans do not know their history. Very few do, and I think that's why the Cook Inlet Historical Society and the Alaska Historical Society are so important, because what you do is so important, and really our state's future depends upon that, of us understanding our history. And I was very clueless when I arrived in Bethel in 1988 to become the news director. I mean, given a lot of responsibility, but terribly clueless. I didn't even know what subsistence was, let alone I hadn't even heard of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. But I have to say, in hindsight, that that job at KYUK was the very best job I have ever had in my life. Just the chance to collaborate with KYUK's UPIC staff, they basically taught me everything I know about storytelling in rural Alaska and set me up for my second favorite job, which was to co-host and produce KTVA's Frontiers program, which focused on rural Alaska and spent a lot of time on Native issues. So, you know, I wasn't an easy student, and compared to Jocelyn here and John, you know, I'm a Johnny come lately to this story. But, you know, I want to talk a little bit about my first day at KYUK. I remember it clearly. It was a clear September day, and I walked into the lobby, which was kind of like a community hangout. People would just come because there was coffee to drink, chat with the receptionist. And when I walked in, there was a guy, kind of a bearded white guy in Carhartts, sitting on the sofa with a gun, big shotgun. And I thought, oh my goodness, what am I getting myself into? And after a while, as I followed the conversation, it turned out that his son, who is an Alaska Native, had just bagged his very first moose, which is very important in Yupik culture, because you share it with elders, the meat, and it establishes you as a contributing member of society. So that was my first little lesson about subsistence. But, you know, I think back the first day in Bethel and towards the very end of my time in 1997, two really odd bookends. In 1997, I covered the first school shooting in Alaska at Bethel Regional High School, in which a principal and a student were killed. And while ANCSA wasn't directly responsible for that, the social ills that arose from the time of ANCSA were things that I covered as well. So on the one hand, I saw the joy of subsistence, and on the other hand, I saw some of the social upheaval that the Alaska Native community was going through. And of course, there were lots of stories that were related to ANCSA that I covered. There was a radio show called Talk Line once a week, and every week almost people would get on the radio and complain about their native corporation, Calista, because Calista wasn't quite as successful initially as some of the others. They didn't pay much in the way of dividends for a long time. In fact, none at all. And they also talked a lot about fish and game issues, their battles with fish and game over being able to hunt and fish as they traditionally have. And one last story I'll share with you is about the Kilbuck caribou herd, which was greatly contested by natives from Akiachuk and Kweethluk. They felt they had a right to hunt there, and they could tell from their on-the-grounds snow machining that the herd was plentiful, but fish and game from their aerial surveys said that the herd was depleting, and they got into a battle, and Kweethluk and their tribal government called a hunt that fish and game said was illegal. Kweethluk tribal government said that it was their God-given right, and they went out and they hunted. And I was at work, but one of my coworkers who was from Queeflick was eating lunch and kind of beckoned me over to this tub of meat. And she said, "You want to try? It's Kilbuck caribou. It's illegal caribou." And so how could you resist an invitation like that? I took a bite, and I feel kind of like that story of Persephone eating the six persimmon seeds that then obligated her to stay in the underworld with Hades, because at that point I was committed. I was committed to learning about subsistence, knowing its importance, that one taste. And ironically, at KYUK, I met Jocelyn Estes. She had been sent as an intern, and what a gift she was, because while we were training her in broadcasting skills, she was an expert in Alaska Native issues. And over the years, I have just been so grateful that I know her and can tap her encyclopedic knowledge of Native issues. And in many ways, I would say that, you know, she is a gem among journalists in Alaska and probably knows Alaska Native issues better than any reporter and has covered them for the longest of any Native reporter in Alaska. Also, one of the things that Jocelyn helped me with was a series that I did on the dental health aide therapist, the introduction of the therapist. At that time, she was a public relations officer at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And the battle was this, that Alaska, in rural Alaska, had one of the highest rates of tooth decay in the nation. And they wanted to put these paraprofessionals in place in communities that could do some basic dentistry under the consultation of a dentist. And the American Dental Association and the Alaska Dental Association fought this, and it's a bad pun, but they fought it tooth and nail. And of course, Jocelyn helped me tremendously by pointing me to the right people to interview for this story. And I feel like it's probably one of the most important stories that I did, because these dental health therapists were needed, and they're making a huge difference in the communities that they went to. And sometimes I think that our state doesn't appreciate really the circumstances in rural Alaska and what little it would take in the way of cooperation to make a huge difference. And at about the same time, I met John Butsky, and it was kind of one of those other really interesting experiences. He was working on a project that was commissioned by Byron Mallott for an AFN economic summit. And one of the producers of that, Jeff Silverman, was unable to go to Hawaii. He had a family commitment come up, and they needed someone to go to Hawaii to look at some archival footage and do interviews. They asked me, and I had never worked on a project like that. And it was an amazing thing to look at how another indigenous group was dealing with their economic development issues. But the thing that I noticed at that convention was that John was bringing in live interviews, presenters from all over the world. And that was very early, before we started to have the kind of robust internet access that we have today, or Zoom. He was one of the pioneers in that, and he continued to do that, you know, broadcasting from the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and bringing in feeds from all over the world. There's probably no one that has done more of that than John, or traveled in rural Alaska taking video than John. But the one thing I learned from that convention was that it was spent the first day of dismal statistics about Alaska Natives, just how horrible their lives were, how many suicides, and people had heard that over and over and over. And then this video that we produced came on, that, and the theme of the video was economic development, how indigenous peoples were taking their culture and using it to develop their economies. And people at the end of that video started cheering. It was just such a strange reaction, but it just stuck in my brain how important and how imbalanced the coverage of Alaska Natives is, that it tends to focus on the failures rather than the successes. And so both John and Jocelyn were my entry points into that realization.
Wow, thank you very much. That's great. Shall we go to Jocelyn? And
sure. Well, Rhonda, we're just in a mutual admiration society of our own. All three of us. You and I started working together. That was either 1991 or 1992. And then, John, I don't even remember. I remember meeting Rhonda because it was in Bethel. John, I don't remember when you and I met, but Rhonda, you were one of my first mentors. And, you know, when I first started, I have to admit it, I was terrible. You know, I didn't know how to write. I didn't know how to voice things. I was working in radio. And I was really afraid to actually be on the air. And Rhonda was really good at putting me on television. And we've worked on lots of projects over the years. And then John, I am still amazed that you have been able to provide live coverage of AFN every year for how many years? 20? Live television coverage. Too long to remember.
25.
Yeah. So I'd be over on the radio side of things, and I'd be watching their show, and I'd be learning things. You know, Sharon McConnell was the host of that show, and so I'd be watching that, and I'd be learning things I wasn't even learning from being there. So great coverage over the years. And Rhonda, I just have to say that story you did on the first school shooting was phenomenal. I mean, it was a very painful, difficult subject, and I just really, I thought you did an incredible job on that. So, John, you can show that first picture I have. This is a picture of my grandfather, Louis Paul, and my great-grandmother, Tilly Tamry Paul. And Rhonda said she came kind of late into the whole land claims thing. I feel like I grew up in the middle of it because my grandfather, well, first Tilly Paul Tamry was, she was arrested for trying to vote in 1920. And she had her other son, William Paul Sr., defend her in court, and he won that case. And then William Paul Sr. and Louis Paul fought for the right to vote, desegregation of schools, the extension of federal and territorial benefits to Alaska Natives, and some other major, major issues. And one of them was land claims. And the Tlingit and Haida got an act of Congress passed in 1935 that gave them jurisdiction to sue in the U.S. Court of Claims to get compensation for lands that had been taken from them without compensation. And most of Southeast Alaska was put into the Tongass National Forest in the early 1900s and the Glacier Bay National Monument. So we went from, you know, being kind of having the world in front of us and being able to do anything and everything we needed to do to suddenly being constricted to, well, you couldn't get, I mean, Alaska Natives couldn't get, mining permits. They couldn't, I can't think of all the things they couldn't do, but it was very difficult to be a part of the economic system back in those days. So the next slide shows me when, that's me in the, I don't even know how to describe what I'm wearing, the button-up coat. And this was about the time that we finally got a judgment in the U.S. Court of Claims. First, there was one in 1965 where the court said, yes, you owned Southeast Alaska and it was taken from you without compensation. So when we got word of this in Southeast, all my elders, my aunts, uncles were all, and my parents, everybody was talking about what they would do when they got all this money. Because, you know, Southeast Alaska is precious, and we thought we were going to get just a huge bundle of money. Well, I mean, people were talking about buying boats and putting away money for college and buying houses, getting their mortgage paid off. Well, as it happened, we only got $7.7 million for all of Southeast Alaska. And this is in a region where just the timber that was being taken and sold was worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And then we also were, there was not a per capita distribution. The money went to the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. So, and then the next slide shows much, much later, I used to go to, Tlingit and Haida loaned some money to the Alaska Federation of Natives to fight for land claims. And I used to go to AFN when I was in my 20s, but I'll tell you, I mostly stood in the hallway outside the main room and hung out and visited with friends. And then just very occasionally, I'd wander in for a little while. And this is where I got my huge education on current contemporary Alaska Native issues. And that is by being the host of gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. And some of the things that came up there were the things that Will mentioned. The corporation started off, they didn't get the land. They didn't get title to the land for, I mean, not even half of it had been transferred 20 years after ANCSA. And so they were supposed to be making money and issuing dividends, but some were very resource poor, including Calista, which Rhonda mentioned. And they didn't have title to the land that they were supposed to be developing to make money. So, Ted Stevens and the congressional delegation worked for many years to amend ANCSA and to create other laws that allowed them to become profitable. And one of them was net operating losses in the 1990s, where they could sell their losses as a tax write-off. So that was one bailout. The next one that really changed everything was the Small Business Administration 8A program. And that gives minority businesses advantages in federal contracting. And the regional corporations were designated as small businesses. And so that, I mean, like Arctic Slope was making good money. Sea Alaska made money from oil. Sea Alaska made good money from timber, and Nana made good money from zinc. But now with SBA 8A, the corporations are much wealthier. So we'll get into this some more. Rhonda and John have some footage from AFN, and we'll be talking about it some more. But it has been a great education, a great learning experience.
Thank you so much, Jacqueline. Let's go to John.
Okay, can you hear me well?
We can.
Okay, let me get back to the PowerPoint here. So I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm not sure what camera I'm using that comes up. I have two different devices running, but I think you're seeing me on the laptop and not the phone. I'm not sure which one, front one. Okay, then it's using, because I have a phone streaming too at the same time. I was trying to use two devices. Technical guy, you know. So anyway, my name is Jonathan Butsky. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I also lived in Nome. My family's history lineage is from the Nome area, Bering Straits area. My mother is Frances Butsky. My father is Richard Smith. My grandmother's Frances Sarah Longley, and my grandfather is O.D. Cochran. My grandmother really, I wanted just to go briefly into our family history for a couple minutes, and it plays a lot into why I got involved in a lot of the coverage was my grandmother was a huge influence. I lived with her for 5 years from the age of 16 to 21. I found out through then that my grandmother has a history of political and native rights activists as well as other people in our family. My second cousin is Alberta Skank Adams, and she was involved with some of the protests and such when she was a teenager, and that some of that was featured in the For the Rights of All film that featured Elizabeth Brodrovich and her actions. My grandfather, O.D., was, of course, a territorial senator in the 40s, and he's the one who wrote the Native Rights Bill, eliminating racism, basically, that was featured with Elizabeth Prochvich in that activity. But basically, my grandmother and my mother, we suffered a loss of our Nupiak language and culture, and it was due to the assimilation of our family and deaths, really more so in the 1919 Spanish flu in Nome. My grandmother was sent to Indian boarding school in Oregon from age 8 until she was 17. So it was really a tragic loss for our family's future, but we overcame that. My grandmother became a founding board member of our Native corporation there, and she was on the board for the health corporation too, and she was the first Native woman to graduate from Nome High School when she did come back from the boarding school. I feel that the blood quantum plays heavily in a lot of things in ASA right now. And it has a lot of discussion going on, especially during the Elders and Youth Conference this year, if you caught any of that. I wanted to play some clips, but I didn't get a chance to get those. It played close to home when I was listening to that, thinking about my own uncles and aunts and cousins. Are they more Native or less Native? You know, that's the big things people are struggling with these days, especially with the Native corporations and sharers and such. Did the U.S. government succeed in this assimilation and the attempt to eliminate Native culture? Well, for my family, the government partially succeeded. We did lose our Nupiak language. We still celebrate our culture and recognize and are heavily involved in all the acts in our corporations and celebrate Native culture heavily through some of my family members too. I have cousins who live a very traditional lifestyle. They do dog mushing and hunting and such in rural Alaska. And then I have some cousins that don't do anything or experience any of the Native culture at all. So it's really goes all over the place with how that's happened. Basically we are just who we are. We need to own it, live it, and be proud. This is what my grandmother always left with me, the powering of being self-aware and to celebrate our cultural diversity that we all have through different generations. I lived with my grandmother for 5 years, as I said, and it awakened my awareness of our culture during that time. And later, a couple of years after, I went to APU and I developed a professional path in media and journalism that allowed me the opportunities to the statewide and international recording and documenting of Native cultures and documentaries and such. Along with the statewide rural concerns in the villages in the state, I covered ANCSA history for many years now. It's been 25, 26 years, I think, I've been covering Alaska Native ANCSA and other topics. I did start my career in 1984, so it's been 37 years I've been doing media. Along with the statewide rural concerns, in the history, I developed awareness and respect for Native history and efforts and the strengths of Indigenous peoples and what they have in the state of Alaska and internationally. My own involvement in ANCs, Alaska Native Corporations, was first as a descendant and was minimal. But now I'm a shareholder of 4 Native regional and village corporations. My participation and insight working on Alaska Native corporations has grown. I provide webcast services to about 14 Native corporations during their shareholder meetings. So it really gives me an insight of working operations that most people don't know of or experience. So I'm pretty lucky with my involvement over the years. I think some of the regional corporations and village corporations, for them to survive their own future, they'll need to embrace all descendants in a way like never before. I think that's the next big issue they're going to be facing. first it was economics, but now it's their own shareholders and descendants. That's going to be a big issue to deal with. I think the role of my children will, let's see, or they'll, you know, they need to, my thoughts are they need to enroll everyone now and make all families shareholders, members, shareholders when they're born. I think of this because my role, the role my children will play in the future of recognizing our family ancestry and our native culture and their own future involvement in the native corporations and the challenges they'll face and all the corporations will face due to this. I've encouraged my children to participate in corporations via college scholarships, joining as junior board members, and a couple have done that. And they all do the scholarships, which I think is a great benefit to descendants and really includes them in and acknowledging the corporations. Parents need to include their children in this by explaining the actions of their corporations and discuss the roles that we all play as shareholders and descendants. Let's see, you know, they need to attend AFN and First Alaskan Elders and Youth Meetings, conferences, and shareholder meetings in general. One thing I've observed over this past few years is that the pandemic and virtual meetings and such has allowed people to attend and be more involved from wherever they are, which is a good thing. But the majority of participants really want to be in person. That's what I've seen, and as we all do. But I say be patient, and it'll come. You know, things will get better. I'm going to go through a few slides here, and I have a couple of few video clips, actually, and hopefully they don't get too lengthy. But let me go through this real quick. So there's my grandfather, Odie Cochran, on the left there with Elizabeth Prochevich, if everybody can see that. And that's where they're assigning the bill. So that has its own story in the background that a lot of people don't know, but I won't get into that. Someday it might all come out the way it was all coordinated. There's a lot of people involved, and that worked really well in the 40s without internet and such. Here's another quick one here. There's my Uncle Gary there in the bottom left. He lives in Nome, and all my cousins up there still. He was the BIA staff person who created or facilitated the actual signing and getting enrolling of ANCSA members and enrollees. So he had a big involvement in that in the early days too. The other one is a photo of my aunts and my mom. My aunt Patricia Cochran there is on the left. My aunt Dr. Mm-hmm. MJ Longley there is in the second. And then my mother is on the right, Fran Butsky. And then the third person from the left is Alberta Skank Adams. And we had the, the wealthy moment or time of meeting her and interviewing her for the Rights of All film when she lived in Colorado. But she's the one who did the protest and got arrested as a teenager and thrown in jail for sitting in the whites only section at the Nome Theater, the movie theater. But she passed away a little bit ago too. Here's a few photos of me. I've been probably to 120, 130, 140 villages around the state over the last 30 years, 37 years, filming different things for different variety of activities. I change a little bit in my looks and such. There's one in Greenland there. I've just been lucky to do training, and I just help media training for youth too, still. Here's one of me doing AFN. There's one back in 1987, I think, when I first started doing production more so. And then there's me probably, I think that's 2014 up in Fairbanks or 12 or something like that. So it's an interesting one. Oh, I wanted to, recognize some of our other journalists, the ones I really respect. There's a ton of them. And I have a few clips I'd like to play if that's okay. Here's one of Nellie Moore when she was interviewing with in the round table with Rhonda and Jocelyn. I thought we should include Nellie in this.
Well, for one thing, up until then, statehood, they were pretty isolated and people didn't really know everything that was going on. I think you heard Willie Hensley mention, you know, we didn't even have phones. I mean, we were used maybe two long distance lines out of Kotzebue and probably a crank phone. So communication back there was very difficult. And the AFN, its work with the Tundra Times newspaper, really brought everybody together to work on this issue, I think.
And that's where we got all those photographs, was from the archives.
I love this interview with you guys.
So are you guys amazed how AFN has evolved, how big it's grown? Like, it started out with a few hundred.
But I'm going to go ahead and go through that one. I just wanted to give recognition to Nellie. I'd known her for quite a while.
So
I've worked with her many times. She likes to give me a good punch in the arm when she sees me.
The rooms that they meet in are also.
Here, Rhonda, here's one for you. Here's one from 1990s. Let people enjoy this one.
Omiyai is attracting attention across the state. Omiyai is the Yupik word for encore. And if you go to dance festivals,
also includes another
call out at the end of an Eskimo dance to encourage the dancers.
Partner of mine in this clip, you'll see Sharon McConnell. Worked with her for many years. Sharon was one of the ones to get me into the field of helping with AFN.
Hello, Alaska. With me is the newest musical sensation hitting Alaska, and it is a Yupik group. And for everyone, your name has been mispronounced so many times. What's the correct way to say it?
Bumya.
And it means?
It means a tail end, or in the instance of dancing, it means encore.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started out, because you've become...
All right, moving on. I wanted to show another one of Sharon interviewing another great journalist that I've known, John Tepon.
96. Welcome, John. First, could you tell us, in 94, there was such a high turnout from Native voters. Do you think we'll see this number in this year's elections?
I think so. We have a better organization than we did back in 94, and that's statewide, and we're also, we've got a very good organization, I think, in Anchorage, something we didn't have back in 94, and better organizations in urban centers across the state. So I think the turnout's going to be a lot better. We've done a real good job with voter registration statewide, and including Anchorage, too. Mm-hmm.
So I've known John, a long time. I did want to make an acknowledgement to Howard Rock, a very famous journalist in Alaska, and I have a short video clip I'd like to play that I found about him that features Dr. Ted Mala, early on, Mary Jane Fate, Lael Morgan, and Tom Snapp.
Howard was an example of how you can live in two worlds with one spirit, and that survival not only took the traditional role of hunting and fishing and subsistence, but today's survival is really based on surviving in a corporate boardroom, surviving in a political world, making informed decisions.
The main question facing Howard Rock as editor of the Tundra Times was, how would Native people survive when their lands were at risk throughout Alaska? After all, a sweeping threat to Native lands came with Alaska statehood in 1959. The federal government said the new state of Alaska was entitled to select more than 100 million acres of land. But this was land that the Native people had lived on for thousands of years. It belonged to the Native people. Natives, though, did not have written title to their land, so there was not much they could do to prove that they owned it.
I don't think any people would ever want to give up any of their land, and I don't think Alaskan Native people will ever give up their land. It's their life, their base of operation, and their spirit and traditions and customs. That's where their land comes in.
Howard Rock believed that for Native people to hold on to their land and heritage, they needed to unify. They could not afford to fight isolated battles, region by region, Native group by Native group. It was through Howard Rock's editorials that the Tundra Times became a unifying voice for Alaska Natives. Tom Snapp credits the paper's success to Howard Rock's gift for writing.
Howard was a master of understatement. He would write an editorial on a real grievous problem of Native people, and he would so understate the thing that even the toughest or strongest opponents would be impressed.
In 1966, Howard Rock's hope for unity took hold when natives across the state met as a group for the first time and organized the Alaska Federation of Natives. It was this organization, the AFN, that would go on to lobby Congress and to win passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. This legislation settled Alaska Natives' long-standing claim to their land, and today it continues to uphold Native land rights. To get the settlement, Alaska Natives had to convince Congress of their legal right to the land. According to Lael Morgan, the Tundra Times was instrumental in influencing
I'm a board member with Lael at the Alaska
Well, the Tundra Times had a very small circulation, but people in Washington, D.C., and in the governor's office and the legislators all read the Tundra Times. It just was very hard to ignore the Tundra Times. It picked up an enormous amount of power.
Howard Rock helped shape a time of great change in Alaska, but he didn't become a leader simply by being in the right place at the right time. He strongly believed in protecting Native land and was willing to fight for it.
Howard had a dream about a newspaper, and he put his life into that newspaper, and everything he needed came along, and as history will tell you later on. He needed money. Somehow, out of nowhere, this money came along. He needed some influence. And, you know, he was nationally recognized and received a lot of awards. He needed help, and all of a sudden, when you least expected, a volunteer would walk in or someone else. And if you look at other people that changed the world, they don't worry about...
I interviewed Dr. Mala many times, but I never saw him.
You know, 20 years of strategic planning. What they do is, in their heart, they do what they think is right. And all these other things fall into being.
He was the voice of the people that weren't being heard.
According to Mary Jane Fate, who served on the newspaper's first board of directors, Howard Rock wouldn't have stopped fighting for Native rights just because the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed.
But I think today, if Howard was here, he'd be very interested and thankful there was Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, because he did tell me so. He was very happy that there was an act, congressional act, but he'd be happier that there are amendments to those acts.
Howard Rock never gave up the battle. He continued to edit the Tundra Times until just before his death. In the spring of 1976, after a struggle with cancer, Howard Rock died. He was buried just outside the village of Point Hope.
Okay, so I'm going to move on. That was over. I just wanted to recognize a couple more people I've worked with for many years. This one has Sharon McConnell, of course, there on the left, and Pat Murphy, who I worked with for probably 7 years. And then Francine Taylor is there on the right. We were doing a documentary there with myself and her back in the 90s. Also, there's Jeff Silverman that I mentioned. He is now the communications press person for AFN still, and I work with him heavily. So I met Sharon and Jeff back in 1995, and they got me, that was my first AFN convention, and I'm still going on with them. In this three pictures, if you see them, I threw them in there because it is freaking funny. Jeff and I worked on a program for DARE Alaska, which is drug and alcohol awareness for teens in schools, and we're doing a video series. And in this video series, Jeff's directing me. I'm usually the camera person on this stuff. But what happened is this scene involved an uncle who is these were all actors and actresses. It involved an uncle who was trying to push beer on his nieces. Well, guess who didn't show up? The person that was supposed to be the uncle. And guess who had to fill in for that part? The camera guy. So there I am being the drunk uncle. That was a good one. Let's see. Here's a quick one I'm going to show of Tom Richards, who is at ANCSCAT 30 and did all the panel discussions and helped document that with John Borbridge. I thought I'll show about a minute of this clip.
I'd like to allow you a few minutes to give a general overview of your impressions about ANCSA and your involvement.
Tom made a significant comment, a brief overview. It is not in accord with the customs of the Tlingit Indians, once we get a microphone, to ever make a brief comment. It would go contrary to everything I learned as a Tlingit. But I'll do the best I can, Tom, to watch the time.
Okay, I'm going to move on. John has a great comment
talk
here,
about it.
And I'd like to like to share those at some point. We'll get this whole collection of that 30th collection will be going to AMIPA and then through the Historical Society reference material. So here's another one. I wanted to make a quote from a gentleman that I never got to interview that I wish I had, was Robert Marshall. He was the first president of Otna Regional Corporation. He passed away in 2019 at the age of 96. In 2018, he did this quote. When he is asked about the things he would change if he could do things over again with the regards to ANCSA, Robert Marshall said he didn't like to talk about things like there was ever a chance to do anything over again any differently. He said, we did the best we could for our people. A few people had foresight, but we had to search out other Native leaders and try to bring their ideas home and talk to our elders and villages about it. Roy Ewan wouldn't let it go. He kept after me, he said. Others and others to learn everything we could about it. Everyone who contributed or worried about what the future would be like for our grandchildren, we did the best we could for them. Quote, it always bothered me that people brushed this off as if it was easily done. ANCSA was life-shaping, and many people don't even realize the benefits they have as a result of it. That's just the way young people are, though. Someday I hope they'll understand. And let's see, moving up. That was it.
Great, John. Thank you so much. That you really gave us a window into that history. I'd like to give Jacqueline and Rhonda a chance to respond or share any additional material they'd like to put up on the screen before we go to the questions from the audience.
Rhonda, go ahead.
I had those three clips ready for you, Rhonda, if you needed those too.
You're muted, Rhonda.
Someone who makes their living out of microphones can't remember to unmute. Such an irony. You know, one thing that really pleased me is I bought this book, and as you were talking about Howard Rock, this book I just got recently, Letters to Howard, an Interpretation of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And what got me curious about it was the letters were anonymous, but they were written by a guy named Fred Big Jim. And he was an ANCSA contrarian. And Howard apparently wanted his letters in there and agreed not to put his name on there so that that opposing view could get there. So Howard really did a service that way by giving both sides of the issue or giving people as much information as they could get to so that they could make a good decision. But this book is such a gem. But the funny thing is the reason I looked it up is because AMIPA has a lecture from Fred Big Jim at APU, which was then Alaska Methodist University. It's black and white on some really weird format. And the anniversary of ANCSA allowed for money to come to have that material digitized, but it was very difficult. And, you know, there is such a wealth of ANCSA material. And, you know, John, you brought up Nellie Moore, and Nellie probably has done the most interviews about ANCSA over a series of decades. You know, she did ANCSA at various periods and did a big documentary of it back in 1986. So, you know, you think about, I think the best coverage of ANCSA has come from Alaska Natives. And you have to ask that question, why is that? Well, I think it's because most of the non-Native reporters are like me. They come to this state and ANCSA is so vast and, you know, such a complicated subject, and they're gone. You know, most reporters come to Alaska as sort of an entry-level market, a jumping-off place to go to bigger communities, bigger cities. And so really, Alaska Natives, whether through other vehicles like AFN, to me, AFN has been kind of one of the biggest communication success stories And you noticed how AFN just seamlessly went to virtual because of John and all the infrastructure that he's built in over the years of doing the live broadcast. So to me, you know, that is just so amazing that if you look back on the history of journalism, I don't think that the mainstream journalism has made as much a difference as the things that natives have done themselves, from Sharon McConnell hosting the live coverage of AFN to your work, John, and Jocelyn doing the live broadcast from AFN for KNBA. I mean, that to me is the richest thing is about this, is that Alaska Natives have probably given us the most documentation of ANCSA and the best coverage, the best way to understand ANCSA. So thank you, John and Jocelyn and Nellie and Sharon McConnell, John Tetpon, all the others that you mentioned, John.
Hey, Rhonda, would you share the Will Mayo video clip with us?
Sure. I just set it up a bit, is that, and this was a footage that came from AMIPA, Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association, but it just shows you how AFN is the ongoing documentary of ANCSA, and this was at a key turning point. John, you want to set this up too, because you probably know the significance of this particular clip better than anybody.
Yeah, you know what? Back in, I think this was 93. Was this 93? I can't remember specifically. Maybe 94.
I'm not sure.
But I was a camera person back there in the front of the stage when this happened. I remember it clearly. But you can set it up, Rhonda.
I was going to say that I chose this to show that Alaska Natives and how AFN documented this, that constant tug of war between the two worlds that they walked in, the Western world and their culture and their traditions. So let's go ahead and watch this.
AFN's work had just begun.
Colonial powers are always trying to rewire your identity, you know, because what they want is control.
When it seems that everywhere we turn, there is some new challenge.
In their new role as corporate shareholders, many Alaska Natives experienced an identity crisis.
Somebody said, it's time that we put away the beads and the feathers. But I say, it's time for us maybe to put away the suit jackets and the ties.
Will Mayo gave AFN's keynote speech in 1993, and people still talk about it today. He traded in his suit and tie for traditional clothes.
Maybe I'll find some beads. And look here. Moose skin.
Mayo told the gathering he wanted to honor ancestors of all Alaska Natives because they loved who they were and what they did.
So I'm going to honor them.
In many ways, a suit is a sign of oppression. A suit is a sign of power. It separates people.
Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, Willie Hensley, Roy Hundorf, early leaders of AFN on a panel for a group of young natives in an executive training program to help them balance the best of both worlds.
I think I'm one of the few who's in my generation that living today that lived in sod homes.
What does that picture say to you?
It's a very powerful image to me.
Three leaders sitting underneath a photograph of them taken when they were young.
The pressure on them is probably unimaginable. They were our voices. And they had to make decisions without knowing the repercussions of them.
Thank you very much, Rhonda. That's great. For our panelists, is there any comment you'd like to make before we open it up to the audience?
Well, I would say that that footage of Will Mayo is still very powerful and moving. And part of it is because Natives were so poor in the early days before the Native corporations were formed. Practically the best, where I grew up, one of the best jobs you could get was to be a teacher. Nobody became a titan of finance until the Native corporations came along. And then the ideal became to be like the Wall Street financiers. And that's where the whole suit and tie thing came into. And so to turn back and say what we were before was good and precious, it was a powerful statement.
Thank you very much. Dick, at this point, we should have some questions from the audience.
Yes, we do. And the first one here is fits right into the Robert Marshall quote there at the end, I think. The question is a statement, then a question. ANCSA is a tragedy, and its destructive regulations extinguished our Aboriginal land claims and consequently has been a process by which our culture is being destroyed. ANCSA corporations today sue their own shareholders. The state of Alaska wants more than it is entitled to, and to this day sues corporations for rights of way upon ANCSA lands. ANCSA required corporations to reconvey lands under Section 14, which further whittled away for our land rights. How can we revoke ANCSA for a more just future? That might be a question for John. Oh, Jacqueline?
Well, I would say I really appreciate the person bringing this up, because one of the issues that has been, so ANCSA didn't do a lot of, it did some things that we didn't want. One of them was it extinguished Aboriginal title. It terminated fishing and, Aboriginal ownership of fishing and hunting rights. And it also issued 100 shares to people who were alive at the time, who were alive on December 18th, 1971. If you were born after that, you could only get shares if you inherited them. And the other thing that it did is it cast a shadow on tribes. So we had federally recognized tribes long before ANCSA. But after ANCSA was passed, the Department of Interior wrote a memo, and the prevailing view for among a lot of people was that tribes didn't exist anymore, that they had been terminated. And then the other thing that this person commenting says is that, there's there's tension between shareholders and the corporate leadership. I remember in the early days, everybody was so disappointed that all we were going to get were dividends, and that it was not enough money to change your life. I did actually buy my first car with my first check, but generally speaking, the dividends for most of us are not enough money to change your life. And in the early years, a lot of people came to the shareholder meetings and they express their dissatisfaction and frustration. But I'll tell this person who commented, it says, how can we revoke ANCSA for a more just future? I don't think it's going to happen, but I'll be happy to hear what John and Rhonda have to say.
Well, I can add in that it was always explained to me that it was a living, evolving document in action that could always be made correct in its time. At the time it needed to be, through discussion and needs of the corporations and the shareholders. That's my understanding.
Yeah, and the corporations are changing. They're taking a friendlier attitude towards tribes, and so I think they are evolving organizations. And so I think you're right. It can be amended. I just don't think it can be revoked. We'll never go back to not having Native corporations.
I think the thing that's so interesting about AFN is watching ANCSA as a work in progress, because it seems that periodically at AFN they revisit parts of ANCSA.
you know, all those things you mentioned, Jacqueline, earlier about being able to sell your losses, the establishment of the small business administration programs that allowed natives to have sole source contracting. So I think there are tweaks along the way. And the interesting thing about ANCSA is that it provided infrastructure and education. So many people got scholarships from these native corporations. They went on to take jobs in tribes. And I think one of the most exciting things you're seeing on the tribal front is this entrepreneurial streak that they too have learned about the small business contracting through the native corporations. And so they are developing economic enterprises. So in some ways, I think that you're seeing tribes and ANCSA come closer together. They still have disputes about resources, mining, for example, Pebble Mine. Although you'll find with Pebble Mine that the Bristol Bay Native Corporation is supporting the tribes. But for example, in the Chilisto region, there are tribal groups that are opposed to development of the Donlin Creek mine. And of course, the Chilista Native Corporation and some of the regional village corporations like the Kuskokwim Corporation, which is a consortium of villages, you know, they're very interested in Pebble Mine for the jobs that it will bring. So, you know, you see these tensions that ANCSA has set up and still have to be resolved. But by and large, you see a lot of cooperation between tribes. You know, for example, you look at the Afognak Native Corporation. They carve a portion of their budget and they give it to the tribes, money for cultural and language programs. So, you know, and the Old Harbor Native Corporation, because they have the expertise in-house, the accounting expertise, they will do projects for the tribe. They will just say, hey, or the city of Old Harbor, they'll say, well, you want us to manage your project for you, we'll donate the in-kind management so that this community can get ahead. So, you know, it's the problem with ANCSA, you know, as a reporter that's covering it, is it's a very complicated story with many moving pieces to it. And you can't look at one Native corporation's experience and apply it each corporation. And wouldn't you agree, John, because you've done so many videos for Native corporations, that each corporation has their own story?
Yeah, I agree. And I would add to that, I don't know if it could be accomplished today, what they did back in 71 as a group.
Well, it took the confluence of some, you know, the state was selecting lands, there was a land freeze, and everybody wanted the oil, and it wasn't going to happen unless they settled land claims. So something I want to add is that, you know, people are confused about the difference between tribes and corporations and regional nonprofits. And so tribes are recognized by the federal government. They get money to provide health and social services kinds of, well, not health, but Indian child welfare, roads, housing, you know, social services. And the corporations were created to make money and issue dividends, and then to also support language preservation and cultural activities. And so they're two very distinct organizations.
Thank you. Dick, do we have another question?
Yes, we do. We have a question that, in addition to the profit corporations, village and regional nonprofits were created. Would you comment on whether those are still active? Are they still conducting interviews with elders, for instance?
You know,
I say that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I have covered so many stories over the years, and you probably have too, Jacqueline, of corporations offering cultural programs, language programs. You know, they do a lot of the historic preservation, and I'm thinking of Koniak. They traveled to Europe and brought back a mask exhibit that some guy from France back, you know, 100 years or so ago carted off a bunch of masks and took them to his chateau, and they brought those back, and it was the first time that that natives at the natives in that area could actually see true representations of their culture. So Native corporations have done some powerful things. But, you know, one thing I thought, Jacqueline, I know you've covered this, is recently the standoff between the corporations and the tribes over COVID assistance money. That shows kind of that the tensions between tribes and corporations are still there.
Yeah. Well, the tribes were allocated funding under the CARES. So there was a section of the CARES Act that was for governments. I mean, the title of that section was, you know, for state governments and for states and tribal governments or something like that. And so, but there was a, anyway, I won't get into the details, but there was a big debate between tribes and corporations about whether corporations should get some of the CARES funding to help their shareholders. And it was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court that they should.
Maybe we have time. Go ahead.
I just thought of something else, and that was to add that it's actually in ANCSA, in the original act, that the corporations will provide scholarships and cultural and language preservation. But the other thing is that if they wanted to select historic sites, they needed documentation from elders. And so that's part of why they were doing oral histories. It was for their land selections.
Now, one thing I do want to mention that we really haven't talked about, and maybe this comes from my perspective of being someone that's just still learning about ANCSA as an outsider to this story, basically, is how much ANCSA has done for the state as a whole. You know, I think about the last big dive in oil prices, and, you know, back in the 80s, you know, when they had $8 a barrel oil during the Sheffield administration, it was such a huge crisis because, you know, they had to lay off hundreds of state workers during that period. But while this last dive in oil prices was really bad, I don't think we suffered as much. And I wonder if it's in part because of Native corporations, because, you know, they pay buku property taxes in Anchorage for all their businesses. They also provide so many jobs. And I would venture to say that probably non-natives in many ways have benefited more than natives from ANCSA. But I don't know. I'm no expert. I wonder what you guys think, John.
Well, I think, you know, your comment about, you know, the Native Corps stabilizing some of the economy in Alaska is right. I know a lot of you think about all the money from all the contracts is, you know, it comes to jobs of people that live here or come back and forth from Alaska that may work out of state and come back. You know, the shares are distributed and spent by the shareholders from the dividends. So, yeah, I agree with that.
I did a story where, or I went to a luncheon where Bill Popp with the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation spoke, and he said that Anchorage was buffered from the worst of the recession because of the tribal health organizations, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and the corporations, because corporations were stable and they were growing, and ANTHC was growing all throughout that downturn in the economy.
Yeah, the Alaska Native nonprofits too, big revenue generator in the state.
Yeah. The other thing is that if you look in Alaska Business Monthly at their annual list of top businesses, I think 15 or 18 of the top 20 are Native corporations. with billions, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in revenues.
And the other thing that's really interesting, a trend I have seen and actually done some stories on, is how Native corporations are buying up local businesses that kind of fit their business model or fit their portfolio. And I'm thinking of Cognac recently, which bought an electrical company on the Kenai Peninsula. And basically they had some other interests in the lower 48 at some oil fields, and they needed, they wanted to be able to do the work, the electrical contracting on that. So they invested a bunch of capital into this company that they bought. And so this company went from being an Alaska company only to a company that serves the lower 48. And I guess the vision was that it would be a source of employment for shareholders who could work a North Slope shift, 3 weeks on, 3 weeks off, and go to oil fields in the lower 48 and come back and forth, live in Alaska, but go out 3 weeks, come back. And I thought that was really interesting that they were trying to solve a couple of problems with one purchase. But Alaska companies have struggled historically for outside investment. That seems to be the thing that keeps them. The banks don't loan the money, and I can think of the Kuskokwim Native Corporation a few years ago bought these apartment complexes in Anchorage that were just kind of regular crime magnets. I mean, I think one of them had like the record for the most police calls, and they partnered with Rick Maestrom, who was a former mayor of Anchorage, but also into the real estate business. And Maestrom taught them how to manage apartments. They refurbished these, and it's kind of become that particular street that the Kuskokwim Native Corporation invested in kind of became sort of your young and up-and-coming professionals' place to buy an apartment. Gone were the meth heads and other people that populated that area. It became upscale, and it was basically because a Native corporation invested capital. And these partnerships that have evolved are changing the economy in many ways. That area is no longer a crime magnet, thanks to the Kuskokwim Corporation's investment.
Hey, Rhonda, can I add into what you're saying there? Thanks. So I wanted to write off what your comment there. And from my observations and what I've seen in a lot of the meetings and discussions that I attend and assist in professionally, is that the two diversity of business purchases and economic growth and evolution of the corporations is always a big concern in what their next steps are. Where's their next stage in evolution of the corporations and what they run and own as far as businesses, subsidiaries and such. Along with the second thing is the descendants and shareholders' future, how that all is going to play with the blood quantum and such. I think those are the two big issues. But economics being the business, obtaining other business ventures is a big one. I agree. That's a lot of discussion happening.
But I guess my point is that for non-natives, that really they've benefited from ANCSA in so many ways that they don't even realize. If we could add up the property taxes that Native corporations pay. But, on the other side of the coin, you're absolutely right. What does that mean for the shareholders, the next generation? And I'm really curious because Calista has, I believe, the most shareholders in their region, the highest number of shareholders, or close to it. Maybe Doyon has more. I'm not sure about those numbers, but they recently created a special stock option for the younger generation. And what's that going to do to that corporation? Because the dollars are going to be diluted that they're paying out among so many people. So those are really interesting questions. And on the other side of the coin, people feel that if they don't have shares and they're not invested, it doesn't help them.
Or if they don't have enough skin in the game financially as a shareholder, why be involved? That's the other thing I think people consider as descendants and future shareholders.
Okay, we'll try to get at least one more question in here. We probably should wrap it up towards 8:30 here, but this question comes in: as time goes by, will the bush population of villages and tribes eventually continue to decrease to the time when those folks will all live in urban areas?
Well, that's up to us, all of us who live in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. We have a role in deciding how viable it will be for people to live in rural Alaska. And, you know, the legislature tried to take all the money out of the power cost equalization program. So the state, when we were rolling in money, invested a lot of money in power projects to reduce the cost of energy in places like Anchorage and Southeast Alaska, other parts of the state. And as part of the deal, the legislature said, and we'll fund a power cost equalization program so that not as much money will go to subsidize energy in rural Alaska, but some money will go there. And now that money, you know, there are attempts being made to take that money away. But the legislature, well, you guys feel free to disagree with me, but it seems to me like the legislature for a long time has pretty consistently voted against sending big projects out and, you know, funding projects in rural Alaska.
Can I add on to that remark? Sure. So my observation for a lot of the corporations and regional corporations, somewhat village corporations, is that many jobs have come to Anchorage or Fairbanks, you know, and such, and nationally. But I think what I've seen is due to technology and other things, people are, and travel, they're able to go back and forth. You know, the employees that might have to come out of the rural homes and such can go back just as fast and easily. And so you're not just living in one place, you're living in multiple places and going back and forth as needed for your own purposes of subsistence or whatever you want. So some people have multiple homes, you know, where they're traveling around, I think, as the corporations have grown financially. So have the opportunities for the shareholders and employees.
One of our people within the audience actually responded also to this question. The last census showed an increase in population in some areas of the larger Western Alaska villages, like out in the Bethel area, and the opposite of the trend for much of the state as a whole, with the exception of places like Mat-Su. And I will also add to that, some areas like Lake and Penborough, I believe, did lose population. So it kind of varies geographically in Alaska as to whether or not people are moving out of villages or moving into villages. And then we have somewhat of a question here, which is, how can ANCSA be made interesting to all students? Any suggestions on that?
I'll jump in there. I created a curriculum for Chukachmute that was focused on junior high students probably about 6 or 7, 8 years ago. And I was trying to find that for today, and I couldn't find the four videos we did for them. They invested a nice chunk into developing curriculum, video and paper book curriculum. But Irene Rowan has been a proponent for like 5 or 6 or 7 years of developing curriculum for the education departments on ANCSA. And I think that was one of her main goals of creating an Alaska Native Media Group, which she roped me into helping her get going. And we still haven't succeeded yet in getting our curriculum designed, but that's still in the steps.
No, I want to jump in here. I was just watching a series that Nellie Moore did in 1986. It was produced by the Northwest Arctic Borough School District. And it had a companion set of studies to go with these videos. There was a curriculum developed around it. But one of the scenes in there I just love is they told the story through a Monopoly game, you know, that only the board had been adapted into an ANCSA-opoly. And, you know, somebody would draw a card and said, you know,
you've lost blah blah blah. and I almost wonder if that's a way, maybe there should be an Anxiopoly game, that because really Anxa is kind of like a Monopoly game. It was a very good analogy. Different corporations did different things with different results, and one of the things that enabled them to come back after failing was the 7i clause, with the profit sharing mechanism of ANCSA. So you were never like really totally out of the game because of that. And maybe Jocelyn or John, you want to explain that? But I think that the Monopoly game, you know, goes on, people making decisions and having a variety of investments. And to tell you the truth, it is the greatest, it is one of the greatest stories of Alaska to be told. And when you think about Emil Noddy, Byron Malott, Willie Hensley, as very young men fighting this huge battle, as young people, I mean, my son is 27, 28, you know, in their age bracket, and I can't imagine him doing anything like this. I mean, it is a story of youth, of working with their elders. I know Georgiana Lincoln, in one of the videos that that Nellie did, she was from Rampart, talked about how in the early days of ANCSA that the young guns for ANCSA would go to the villages, talk to elders, get their inputs about what they wanted because they didn't speak English. And so it was basically young people working selflessly for their elders. And to me, that is like one of the greatest stories to inspire young people. I mean, forget the Anxiopoly. It's the inspiration of the story. And just to think what people could do if they all work together, it's an amazing story. It could be a good movie, don't you think, John?
Yeah. Well, my thoughts are you need to enroll everybody that's born as a shareholder at birth. And I mean, my thoughts, how to educate them is they need to be enrolled and engaged from the beginning.
Well, and you know, something that has succeeded is everybody knows Elizabeth Paradovich's name now. And it's because there was a play written about it. And in the play, somebody gets to read some of her speech that she made before the state legislature. And if you listen to the speeches that were made in support of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, many of them were really powerful and eloquent. So that's another thing that could be brought into play. The other thing I wanted to add earlier, I mentioned that the state is not investing in rural Alaska. And one of the ways it's not doing that is by not funding water and sewer projects. I mean, if you, we have more than 30 villages that don't have flush toilets or running water, which is shocking. I mean, that's more like, I think 6% of the population in Alaska lacks water and sewer. And in the rest of the country, it's like half of 1% lacks running water. And I mean, it's shameful, but that's another way in which, I mean, you know, it would cost a lot, but it can be done if the will were there. And we've certainly wasted a lot more money than, you know, we've wasted a lot of money on kind of pie in the sky projects that, well, what was the one for the, well, I won't name them, but just.
There's too many.
Yeah. So anyway, that's all.
Yeah. Well, did you want to say something?
Oh.
We do have one comment came in also that partly answering one of the questions, one of the audience members said, Tanana Chiefs did two films on Alaska land claims and U.S. federal Indian policy that were geared towards high school and college audiences. And I think with that, one request I do have is, John, can you fill us in as to where people can watch the AFN convention online, which will be December 13th and 14th?
All right, that's a good question. They're still developing that one. I just had my engineer call me today, Pete Cyril, say, what's going on here? K&B wants to know. I'm like, I don't know yet, but it will probably be on their website for sure. And 360, not 360 North, they changed their name to KTOO.
It's Miranda? 360 TV, just 360 TV.
Now. Yes. And of course, streaming Elders and Youth just wrapped up yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I did that production. That was on Facebook Live, YouTube, 360 TV, and also on their website. So there's lots of opportunities for people to find that content too. It's live there. And they had some great discussions. Even though it's all Zoom and virtual, there's some great discussions going. I don't know if Rhonda and Jacqueline, you guys had time to watch all of it like I did every minute.
See, that's it. Is it's your job to watch these things. And I do have a quick question for you, John, is how was Willie Hensley's keynote speech? Because he was reflecting on
that
15
was good.
Years.
Yeah. No, it was not long. I mean, it was good, and there was lots of discussion. I mean, I won't get into it, but everybody can go back and watch it on YouTube or something. But it's all there. It was great. I loved what it was some good discussion. The youth keynote was good too.
I'll just toss one more thing out, and that is that for people who want to learn more about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I'm sure Rhonda and John and I, we all have our favorite books or films or whatever, and we can send that to Cook Inlet Historical Society, and you can make that information available to people, maybe?
Yes, we could, and that would be wonderful. And I know Will is actually trying to compile a list of all relevant publications and so on ANCSA as part of the 50th anniversary recognition. Will, do you want to close with some concluding remarks?
Yeah, I would, and I'll be brief, but I want to give my appreciation to the panelists. You gave us so much of your personal insights and experiences. You gave us a unique window. I don't know that this type of window has been provided before to the general public. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it, John and Rhonda and Jacqueline. Thank you.
Guiana.
Merci.
Gunesh Chish. Yeah, thank you for having us. Thank you for those who are still hanging in there listening and watching. Thanks. Thanks for hearing us out.
Well, I really want to thank Will Schneider for assembling and moderating tonight's discussion, and a big thank you to the panelists, Jacqueline, Rhonda, and John. Great insights about people, stories, issues, challenges of ANCSA over the last 50 years. And I also want to thank Rebecca at the museum for making it possible to hold this event online. For your friends, neighbors, relatives who could not make it tonight, the link will be posted on our website as well as the museum's website, and you can also watch this recording when you go back to the same place where you registered. And a quick reminder, on November 18th, we will feature a lecture by Tom Kazaya on his recent book, Cold Mountain Path, about the lost decades in McCarthy and Kennecott. You can register for future talks at either the Cook Inlet Historical Society.org website or the museum's webpage. And again, we encourage you to join or donate to Cook Inlet Historical Society. And I want to thank you all for tuning in tonight. And again, a big thank you and a round of applause to the panelists.